At the end of my drinking, I was not able to do anything except drink. I was afraid of people. I was unable to work. I was completely dependent upon booze in order to do the most important thing that I have to do, and that is live with myself.
Every time I picked up one drink, I couldn't stop. I knew that I was going to get drunk, and I blacked out every time I drank. So that it was a thing that I knew that I was utterly destroying myself and not seeming to care.
I'm Michael, I'm 15. I had to quit school because of drinking while I was drunk. I used to cuss people out. I wanted to kill everybody. You know, I couldn't stand people around me. I hated my home. I hated my parents. And, you know, like, I hated everything.
It got so bad at the end, I could no longer take it. It was no longer fun. I was too desperately ill and running around to doctors and hospitals and everything.
When I realized I'm not going to die, but I'm going to stay alone and be alone for the rest of my life and live sick and without people and without God.
The voices of alcoholics. Describing the depths of their drinking episodes when they hit their so-called bottom that finally led them to their recovery from alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholism within this generation has been viewed as an addiction, afflicting weak-willed people without character. Now, fortunately for the 9 million alcoholics in this country, this damaging belief is changing. The American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and our courts are recognizing it as a disease. Among the misconceptions still held by some is the myth that most alcoholics are skid row bums. Actually, only about 3% of our alcoholic population inhabits the thousands of skid rows of our land. Nevertheless, this is a serious problem, for more than 95% of all short-term prisoners are in jail because of alcoholism, and many of them are from skid row. However, on New York City's Bowery, there are very few arrests for drunkenness. Instead, the Bowery alcoholic who may be lying near death in a rubble-strewn vacant lot is picked up by the Bowery Manhattan Project and given emergency treatment. The medical director of this 48-bed hospital in the old municipal lodging house, Dr. Robert Morgan, gives us a description of the Skid Row alcoholic.
The average man on the Bowery who is admitted to our treatment facility is about 45 years old and has spent about 20 years on Skid Row. A third of these men are brain damaged. Another third are schizophrenic. The remaining third has serious personality disorders. Our street rescue teams go out on the Bowery and pick up the people that they find in the worst kind of physical distress. They're treated here medically, x-rayed, and sent on to rehabilitation units. We also have our own rehabilitation clinic. In a 5-day program, we provide excellent emergency care, but we do not hope to turn out new men in 5 days. However, we do free up police courts and jails and bring the treating professions into the care of the physically and emotionally deteriorated Skid Row alcoholic.
The identification of the alcoholic as a derelict has had a harmful effect on other alcoholics. These are the alcoholics who have drunk themselves into oblivion, destroying their business, social, and family relationships, refusing to accept the fact that they were alcoholics because they were far removed from the Boweries of their neighborhoods. Who is the American alcoholic? We asked Senator Harold Hughes, himself a recovered alcoholic, who, as chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Alcoholism and Drugs, has participated in exhaustive studies and hearings on alcoholism.
The average alcoholic in America today is 31 years old. He's a junior executive, father of 2 children, living in a decent home, working every day of his life, and he is an alcoholic who is progressing on down the drain. Or it's his wife who's living in that comfortable home, sitting alone in the daytime in a dirty smock, unable to do the housework. The children don't want to come home to see her. He's covering it up because he doesn't want the neighbors to know it, and they don't know where to get help. They're ashamed. The family eventually breaks up in either case, and it goes on down that drain.
Pain does not adequately describe the whole thing. I
and I didn't have guts enough to really commit suicide or to die, but I didn't have courage enough to live, but I couldn't stand living that way anymore.
So I started off drinking, I think, to become an adult, and I stopped drinking because it made me a child. I was arranging the events of each day to coincide with drinking. The death wish was very strong. Toward the end, it affected my work to the point where I had lost a sense of conscience about what I was doing. My personal relationships were disintegrating because I did not believe that people were behaving toward me as I thought they should.
I found myself away on vacation and absolutely unable to go more than an hour or two without a drink. I couldn't drive into the village. I couldn't go out on the beach. And I was very afraid to get away from my own base of operation because I was afraid I wouldn't be able to get a drink fast enough.
I didn't want to say I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to call myself an alcoholic. I was if you call me a lush or bum or something like that, it was, I guess, all right. But I was a professional actor, and being drunk on stage was the most unforgivable thing that I could do to me.
But I reached a point where taking a drink wouldn't help. And at that point, too, I could no longer find excuses for my drinking, and that really was my bottom. I couldn't blame anyone. I was faced with the terrible problem of what to do. Thank God I did what I did.
Those are alcoholics who recovered with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. How many alcoholics continue to drink and lose everything they value in life, if not their lives, is not accurately known, because for many, this is still a hidden disease. However, industry and the government is becoming enlightened. Congress passed the Hughes Bill establishing an Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for the prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation of the alcoholic. The bill also provides that the federal government, our largest single employer, gives the same employment benefits to alcoholics as it does to employees suffering from other diseases. How large is the problem in industry? We asked Dr. Luther Cloud, Senior Medical Director of the Equitable Life Assurance Society of America and Chairman of the National Council on Alcoholism.
We're dealing with close to 3 million employed alcoholics. Employed meaning that they are daily, gainfully employed in our American industries. We used to talk in a cliche about industry's billion-dollar hangover, and it's only been when some hard statistics have come to light in the last few years that we realize what pikers we've been. It's not a billion, it's four billions of dollars. And this is really only the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, because what we can measure in dollars and cents is lost time, lost productivity, the increasing cost for hospitalization, and so forth. But there's no way to measure the mistakes that an alcoholic makes when he's under the influence of his drug. And there's no way to measure how much this means in terms of public relationship or how much it means in goodwill for his organization.
How is industry's attitude toward the alcoholic changing?
We are simply conceptualizing that alcoholism is an illness and therefore must take its place in a health program with other illnesses, with other diseases. Firing the alcoholic, which was so prevalent 2 decades ago, did a great disservice to the person. It didn't really help the employment situation because a skilled man had to be replaced. And perhaps deadliest of all, it simply meant that industry and you and I as private citizens had to pay more taxes to build more sanitariums, more hospitals, and more welfare funds for the people that were now unemployed. And one thing we can do is uncover the illness in its earliest stages when something can be done. If the individual is physically ill, if the liver, if the nervous system, if the digestive system have been injured by the continuous ingestion of alcohol, we can provide physical treatment methods. We can sponsor them in organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous. We can get them to religious modalities where this is necessary. We can use group psychotherapy, individual psychotherapy. But it seems to me that industry's job is to do something about early case finding, early detection first.
What success is industry having in the rehabilitation of the alcoholic?
we have found that we can talk of rehabilitation rates from between 60 to 70 to 75%. That's two-thirds to three-quarters of all the alcoholics in a controlled industry program will recover. Now, by recover, again, obviously, we do not mean that he is forever and ever cured. This is a chronic disease. It is with an individual all his life. But by controlling the situation, by giving him company support, by giving him outside treatment, at least 60% to, again, 75% of these individuals have a very, very favorable prognosis.
The man appointed to head the new division of alcohol abuse and alcoholism, set up by the Hughes Bill, is Dr. Morris Chaffetz, who was professor in the psychiatry department at Harvard University and directed the alcoholism unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. He discusses the concept of curing the alcoholic.
Too many of us are still hung up on the cure model for most of the problems we deal with in health issues today. I think we don't cure diabetes. We don't cure heart disease. We control them. We bring them under control, make the people more comfortable and able to function better. And I think this is how we have to view alcohol problems. I'm not sure that we cure people, as I understand it in its deepest philosophical and medical sense, but we sure help a lot of people to be able to function better and feel better. And I think that if you view it that way, then the treatment program has to be individualized, tailored. For some people, one modality will work. For others, a different modality or a combination of modalities. And I think that one of the reasons a lot of alcoholism treatment programs have not succeeded is that they have tried to fit the patient or the person into the treatment program rather than to fit the treatment program to the person.
Dr. Chaffetz believes that the problems of alcoholism are increased because our drinking habits are bad.
What concerns me is that American people really don't know how to use alcoholic beverages. They focus very heavily on it. They use it for the effect. They center their relaxation about it. And most horrendously, they accept as normal drinking behavior the state of intoxication, which is a state of illness. And no one has defined for this country what is responsible drinking. We feel this is a charge and a responsibility of us to come up with a definition of what is responsible drinking and non-drinking for the American public. You can see thereafter, if that definition is put forth, how easy it would be to determine for yourself whether or not you have a problem with alcohol.
Dr. Chaffetz discusses man's need to change his reality.
Throughout the history of mankind, as we have it recorded, man has needed to change his reality through a variety of mechanisms. If you look at the baby standing in his playpen, he wiggles his head around so he gets dizzy, gets a high so that he doesn't get bored with it. And, of course, as supposedly we get more sophisticated, we use more sophisticated mechanisms of changing our reality. Now, alcohol has been a mind-altering drug dating back from the early moments of recorded history. And all of the efforts of society to get rid of it, whether it's in a democratic system or in a totalitarian system, have proven to be of no avail. Obviously, as life becomes more complex and the stresses are greater from urbanization and a variety of other inputs, it may be possible that alcohol will not suffice. I think that one has to accept this need of man to alter his reality. What one is striving for is that when he alters his reality, he does not destroy himself or the rest of society.
My bottom was on Christmas Eve morning, 1965, waking up in a local jail, not knowing where, why, how, or anything else. I'd been in a blackout, only to find out that I had three counts of assault and battery on the police and drunk and disorderly and other sordid charges.
Stopping drinking has brought me a total new way of life. First of all, it's restored my will to live. I no longer feel hopeless. I can look people in the eye, be honest, happy, and I realize that my life is absolutely my own.
I can face my problems now, you know, I can deal with them, I can cope with everything now. You know, like, I feel like living now, and I feel like a brand new person.
Psychiatrists and psychologists are altering their concept as to what psychotherapy can do for the alcoholic. Dr. Robert Campbell, who is a psychiatrist at St. Vincent's Hospital and training director of New York's Alcoholic Recovery Institute, was asked if psychiatry could return the alcoholic to normal social drinking.
Psychiatry can sometimes help to reduce the anxieties that started the drinking in the first place, but they really cannot make the alcoholic a social drinker. Most people now feel that psychotherapy, including psychoanalysis, may be very helpful to the alcoholic who has other problems, but it doesn't enable him to become a social drinker.
In what area do psychiatrists have the most success with alcoholic patients?
The highest success is in those who, first of all, can admit that they're alcoholics, who, secondly, are willing to go through a sometimes very difficult program of withdrawal and retraining in their lives so that they don't have to drink and use it as a crutch every day. In general, the person who is identified as an alcoholic has made alcohol the center of his life for a long time, a great many years, and obviously giving that up means that that whole part of his life is going to have to change. I'm aware of the fact that a great many successfully recovered alcoholics can refer to a conversion experience. They suddenly saw the light, recognized what alcohol had done to them, and saw that they really had to give it up if they were going to live. What differentiates them from the person who can maybe recognize he has a problem but just cannot give it up? It may be a conversion experience, it may be a religious experience, it may be the personality of the therapist that he's exposed to. We really don't know, but it obviously requires something within the person himself to enable him to participate effectively in whatever treatment measures might be applied to him.
Dr. Campbell was asked why alcoholism was one of the most difficult diseases to treat.
It certainly is baffling, and it certainly is difficult to treat, because we're dealing not only with a craving, an addiction, if you will, but we're dealing with the results of years of change physiologically in the body, and how much is pure alcoholism, how much is secondary effects of alcoholism on the brain, on the liver, on other tissues of the body, and how much is a secondary or even tertiary effect of the social and psychological difficulties that the drinker gets into when he drinks. It's a very baffling combination and very difficult to tease out any single factor that one can focus on and say, that's where the answer is.
Dr. Ruth Fox, a New York psychiatrist, has treated nearly 5,000 alcoholics in the past 30 years. She was asked if she thought alcoholics differed from people who don't have a drinking problem.
I think alcoholics are just pretty much like the rest of the population. There are all kinds of people. I think a person who is rather immature and maladjusted is perhaps more apt to continue drinking, and it's maybe more difficult for him to give it up. As a matter of fact, I became a psychoanalyst simply because I thought I'd get a better answer to alcoholism. I found that was not the answer at all, that a here-and-now normal approach with AA and abuse frequently will do the job, get them over the habit of drinking. But I find that the majority of patients of mine who stop drinking are just as normal as the rest of us.
Dr. Fox tells how adolescent drinking leads to alcoholism.
Those who started to drink in adolescence because they felt very inadequate, insecure, uncomfortable, embarrassed, and they found that alcohol was the great answer to their problems. And then the tendency was, whenever they were in a social situation, they felt as though they had to drink to feel at home. And then they began to use it whenever they were in a difficult situation. See? Now, if this person has the underlying chemical disturbance, which we think is there, this has not been proven, but we think it's there, then he is very apt to become alcoholic. Now, another person in adolescence may take a little bit of alcohol, and it eases the situation, and it's very pleasant. But he is developing other resources in his life. Therefore, if he decides to stop drinking at 45, it's much easier for him because he has a former good adjustment he can go back to, whereas the one who has been drinking all of his life and was neurotic to start with really has the emotional equipment of the adolescent who started to drink because he's never tried to use other avenues of self-expression.
Dr. Fox discusses the alcoholism of leaders in American society.
I have many executives and quite a lot of doctors and some psychiatrists and stuff like that as patients. They do tend to work very hard. I think there might be almost a tendency for the alcoholic to have very high standards for himself, and therefore he works unusually hard. So he may become almost something like a work addict. And then he, of course, gets tired, and he finds out that alcohol will relax him, make him feel better. So he may drink more and more often, and then he gets into a more affluent society, and more cocktail parties, more drinking, until finally he may become addicted.
Dr. Bernard Hall, a psychiatrist, was on the staff of the Menninger Clinic in Kansas for 22 years. He now heads up a new alcoholic program established at Roosevelt Hospital in New York. He was asked, can a psychiatrist treat an alcoholic with any degree of success if he continues to drink?
I think it's rather foolish, personally, to try to treat a patient who indeed has the disease alcoholism with psychotherapy while he is drinking. I've tried it. I've had no success at it. I have known other colleagues have tried it. They've had no success at it. I think the role of a psychiatrist in helping someone that is drinking excessively and who does have this disease is to help him achieve what the Alcoholics Anonymous people refer to as a kind of resignation to the fact that they have the disease, and to help him accept that because he does have the disease, that the best treatment for it is participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. But to treat him psychologically, to try to uncover unconscious causes for his alcoholism, I think is a waste of time, and I personally would not be able to do that.
Why does it appear that Freudian psychoanalysis has had such little success in treating drinking alcoholics?
The major contribution, it seems to me, that Freud made to mankind was that he offered hope for the mentally ill, and he did that by saying that emotional illnesses have causes like other diseases. Many of those causes are unconscious, and if they can be made conscious and the person helped, he can be free of his emotional illness. This was the first time we really had a scientific basis for a theory of therapeutics. Now, unfortunately, Freud didn't say that that applied to all diseases, but some of his followers, not being the scientist that he was, began to apply it so that alcoholism, because it did appear to be a behavioral disorder, was included as a disease that could be cured by simply uprooting the unconscious causes that led the fellow to drink. And lots of people spent many hours on psychoanalytic couches and in psychiatrists' offices being treated while they were drinking in an attempt to find the unconscious reasons for their drinking, where at the same time the patient and the doctor denied that they had a disease which the patient indeed was dying of.
I have the wonderful feeling every morning when I wake up that I do not have to drink anymore, not in that particular 24 hours. It's a marvelous feeling, and it gives me great peace and great happiness. I also feel very well physically. I've regained the respect and admiration of my family, which I had lost completely. And I feel as though I am becoming the woman that I always wanted to be.
Well, I've gained an ease with people. I was never at ease with people, especially strangers. I find now that I can meet strangers and talk to them, where I never could before. I find that I have a lot more patience now with other people. Just about anyone, like people at work or people that I come in touch with each day. And I'm a lot more at ease with myself. I don't expect so much of myself anymore. And I've gained a definite freedom where I don't have to base my day on how much alcohol I can consume, which used to govern where I went, who I went with. Now I'm free to do as I choose.
The federal government's Health, Education, and Welfare Department has called alcoholism the nation's number one health problem. The FBI says that every third arrest in the country involves public intoxication. And a major insurance company estimates that by the end of 1971, the drunk driver will have killed 35,000 persons. Yet, relatively little research has been done on the disease because of lack of funds. However, that research does indicate that there may be a biochemical reason for alcoholism. Dr. Frank Sachs, medical director of the National Council on Alcoholism, reports that over 50% of alcoholics have at least one alcoholic parent. One of the leading researchers in this field is Dr. Stanley Gitlow, who is president of the American Medical Society on Alcoholism and clinical professor of medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He discusses where the research is leading.
The real question right now is whether or not there is an abnormality in biochemistry of the brain. There is very little in the way of hard fact about this at the present time, but equally, our lack of knowledge implies that we can't be certain that there isn't something in brain metabolism, the biochemistry of brain function, such that would tend to make a person an addict more easily than another individual. It's certainly true that you can expose a lot of people to alcohol, and you can expose a lot of people to pain-relieving drugs, morphine after surgery, and things of that sort. Very few become addicts.
What is the effect of alcohol on the biochemistry of the body?
Alcohol has a dual effect. It's a sedative during the first couple of hours after it's ingested, and then it causes increasing agitation. This increasing agitation lasts for about 12 hours after a single drink. He has increasing anxiety and discomfort. Now, if he drinks repeatedly, then he will repeatedly get the sedative effect, but he will add up the agitating long-range effect, such that over a period of days, weeks, months, or years, after a lot of ingestion of alcohol, he will agitate himself to the point that he will, of necessity, have to go through a rather severe and untoward reaction to the withdrawal of alcohol. The amount of alcohol that has to be drunk in order to get the same amount of sedation is greater than it was originally, and that's the hook. Right there. That means that you have to keep on drinking, and you have to keep on drinking fairly large amounts in order to maintain even a semblance of normalcy.
How does prolonged compulsive drinking affect the alcoholic?
The continued use of large quantities of alcohol over a prolonged period of time will eventually result in such a great loss of central nervous system, of brain function, human being is unable to function. Some years ago, in reviewing my own records, I had to look over those patients' charts who expired, and I was amazed to find that the rule, rather than the exception, was that my alcoholic patients who failed to recover died suddenly and violently in almost every instant. Surely some of them died of cirrhosis, but the majority died by wrapping themselves around a pole in a car, or falling out of a window or down some stairs, or a purposeful overdose of sleeping pills, or a non-purposeful overdose taking alcohol and tranquilizers, or you name it. But almost without exception, it was sudden and violent death.
Recently in New York City, one of the nation's largest hospitals, New York Hospital, changed its rules to admit patients diagnosed as alcoholic. This is progress in the treatment of alcoholism, but it is slow. For although the American Hospital Association recommends that general hospitals treat alcoholics as patients, about two-thirds of these hospitals do not admit alcoholics. Some hospitals, though, such as Roosevelt Hospital in New York City, are establishing special treatment programs. Dr. LeClaire Bissell, the coordinator of alcoholic services, tells how the program works.
What we do with an alcoholic patient is not really that different from what a doctor does with any other disease. The first thing that's done is that we make a diagnosis. Is this patient alcoholic or is he not? The next thing we do is communicate that diagnosis to the patient. And this is a little bit more difficult than it is in other diseases because no alcoholic wants to be an alcoholic. And the patients frequently have some rather strange ideas about what being an alcoholic entails. So we have to teach a lot, and we have to explain a lot, and bring the patient around to accepting that this is indeed the problem. For some patients, education and Alcoholics Anonymous is quite sufficient. For others, group therapy is required. For certain others, it may be individual counseling or individual psychotherapy. For others, sometimes drug treatment is necessary. Sometimes prolonged hospitalization is required. All depends on the individual case.
Why does an alcoholic patient find it so difficult to admit that he is an alcoholic?
Ours is a Puritan culture in which alcoholism has for many years been regarded as a moral disorder, rather an ecclesiastical disorder, if you will, rather than as an illness. The patient participates in the same culture as the rest of us. And if he has been taught that alcoholics are weak-willed people or bad people, he has to be brought around to seeing that this is indeed a disease entity and can be approached in that way.
Hospitals treat many more alcoholics than drug addicts. There are in the United States 9 million alcoholics and 300,000 drug addicts. However, the drug problem receives more attention and funds for research. What's the reason for this?
Alcoholics do not tend to rob apartments. They don't tend to assault people in the streets. Therefore, people are not afraid of the alcoholic, who tends to die quietly in his doorway or die at home, and are much more upset over the narcotic addict, whom they feel is responsible for the rising crime rate. The other aspect of it is that relatively few alcoholics are children. And I think as soon as we see our children getting into difficulty with the drug, we become much more upset.
If a doctor prescribes the drug Antabuse for an alcoholic, and he takes it, and then drinks, he will become violently ill. Dr. Bissell discusses how Antabuse is used in alcoholic therapy.
One type of patient who finds it very beneficial is the man or woman who's fighting the bottle all day long and has to decide perhaps 10 or 15 times in the same day whether or not he's going to drink. This patient may be pretty exhausted by evening just from turning it over in his mind all day long. Is he going to drink? Isn't he going to drink? It's a great relief then to take one tablet once a day and have the decision made and have his mind free for other things.
Although authorities in the field of alcoholism may disagree on what causes alcoholism, there is complete agreement that Alcoholics Anonymous, founded in Akron, Ohio, 36 years ago by an alcoholic stockbroker, Bill W., and a surgeon, Dr. Bob, has been the most successful program in sobering up alcoholics. Today, AA has nearly 500,000 members in 18,000 groups in 92 countries. Mrs. Marty Mann, who founded the National Council on Alcoholism 27 years ago, on the key to AA's success.
I think the main reason for AA's success is that helping other alcoholics is part of their own recovery program. Now, this means that it goes way beyond just alcoholics. I mean, this is a whole attitude toward life. It's a view of the human being as he ought to be. And I think most people, alcoholic or not, have a deep-seated need to feel that they are useful, that they can help other people. And unfortunately, in modern times, their avenues of doing this have been pretty restricted.
What part does willpower play in the recovery of an alcoholic?
Willpower, in the ordinary sense, is not what gets them over alcoholism, because they use it in a misdirected way until they learn all about alcoholism, what it is, what they have to do to get well. For instance, I had no idea, the last 5 years of my drinking, that the answer was not to drink at all. Nobody ever told me that. So I kept trying to control my drinking, which is the one thing an alcoholic can't do. Willpower doesn't work in that area. And what you can't do is to drink two or three drinks and then stop. What you can do is stop drinking altogether.
Do recovered alcoholics feel resentful about having to give up a socially accepted way of life when they stop drinking? Or do they overcome resentment by what they have gained?
You have to gain something in order to make it worthwhile. Now, if it's not worthwhile, people are not going to enter into that problem. You know, it's for the alcoholic, it's a big deal giving up drinking. He's dependent on drinking to get him through life. He's dependent on it to solve all his problems. He's dependent on it to give him a reason for living almost. His life is built around a bottle and drinking. He's not going to give that up unless you offer him something that's better than what he had before. That actually life is going to be fuller and richer and pleasanter than he ever dreamed.
Sobriety has given me a new outlook and a new look at me, and the reflection isn't that bad. It's given me my self-respect back. Without that, there's hardly any foundation for living in the social community. There are the simpler things of life that I've overlooked in the past. The beauty of my six-year-old daughter riding her bike, sunrise and a sunset, the happiness of my nine-year-old son playing catch me in the backyard. And sobriety has finally given me the ability to be myself.
Somehow, besides stopping drinking, which was necessary for survival, this inward desperation, the searching for myself, it somehow just disappeared. And I have lots of hope. You know, it's a continual hope instead of a continual desperation, which is what my life was.
Being sober has meant just a much better life. To be able to feel, to relax, to enjoy myself, to enjoy being with myself, and to appreciate the type of person that I am, and that I can receive help, and that I can share in joy, and that I can get just as much out of giving as receiving.
I made friends with myself. I don't particularly like myself. I don't particularly approve of myself, but I know myself now. I know that I'm in control of my actions. I'm not enslaved to anything excepting what everyone else is, you know, the economic battle of survival in our society. But I'm not unique anymore. And yet when I was drinking, I felt unique. Now I'm a functioning human being with the problems of every other so-called functioning human being.
Senator Harold Hughes's efforts on behalf of the 9 million alcoholics in this country will certainly start a new chapter in the history of alcoholism. His Hughes bill, when it is funded, will provide $100 million a year in this field. Hughes is one of the leading authorities on alcoholism, gained both from his experience as an alcoholic and the hearings that were held all over the United States by his Senate Subcommittee on Alcoholism. He was asked about the public's misconceptions about alcoholism.
I'm continually amazed, as much as I talk about the subject with the at the level of press, radio, and television, for example, that I continue to read stories, you know, about me, that I am a reformed alcoholic. Well, you know, I am a victim of a disease, which is alcoholism, and you don't reform from a disease. You recover from it if you find the way and the means or the medication to recover. But that continuously comes up in descriptions orally, in the printed word, on the written page. The misconception in much of the areas of the medical profession, the hospitals, the teachers, anywhere you look, there is a misconception about alcoholism. And as long as that remains, that this is some sort of a moral weakness related to a character instability or deficiency, then we're going to face a problem.
He discusses the best way of removing the stigma and the prejudice about alcoholism.
If the millions of Americans who have been touched by this disease are willing to publicly say, look, I've been touched by it, my family's been touched by it, we found a solution, we're out of it. There are so many prominent Americans that are could be the words on the lips of every American citizen today. They're well known, who themselves have been alcoholics but will not publicly admit it, and it because of the public opinions related to it. You know, it's about like talking about gonorrhea yet in the minds of many people. People don't want to talk about alcoholism. They think it's some sort of a indication that they're a moral weakling or that they haven't the competency other people have as a result of it. Just not the case. These people are going to have to come out of the weeds. They're going to have to come out of the closet. You know, I'd like to get together 12 prominent people who I know who are recovered alcoholics and say to the world, look, we're all alcoholics. Look at us. See us. We're not a specimen of dirt from some back place behind the barn, you know. We have had this problem. We learned to face it, live with it, overcome it. And you can do the same thing. I think you'd see a real awakening in America if that could happen.
This is happening. Mercedes McCambridge, the Oscar award-winning actress, for one, admits that she is an alcoholic.
I have the problem, but the problem no longer has me. Through the offices of a brilliant doctor and some very understanding people who convinced me that I was not a moral pariah, that the self-loathing and despair I felt, the absolute despair to the point of not wanting to live, because I felt I was weak-willed and that I had betrayed my own self-respect, the respect of people near me, the respect of my God. The stigma that has been attached to alcoholism is not only unjust, it comes from ignorance. There is no more stigma attached to my disease than there is to diabetes or than there is to tuberculosis. It's the same thing. It's a physical disease which can only be arrested, never cured.
Senator Hughes was asked how he managed to continue on a successful political career after he admitted publicly that he was an alcoholic.
The people of Iowa matured to the problem due to my willingness to talk about it and the nature of what I had done before publicly many stories were written about it. And then having gone through election after election and seeing the reactions, the way I faced the problems, the way I faced the issues, and handled the government, they gained in confidence. But now in relationship to the talk of a potential dark horse president candidacy, the question comes up again and again. Should we have a man in the White House who admits that he has been an alcoholic? Well, I think if people want to read history very well, they can find out that several of our presidents had difficulties with alcohol. They didn't call themselves alcoholics. They probably thought they were just very fine social drinkers. But it was obvious to the people of their day that they drank to excess. The dangers of our time require a level-headed and sober mind at all times. I'd feel much more secure with a man in the White House who didn't drink than one who does.
Senator Harold Hughes on the pattern of his alcoholic drinking.
I struggled for years to find combinations of liquors that I might drink and maintain my sobriety. You know, and sometimes I got by with it for months in a row, and then suddenly I would lose control and become heavily intoxicated and swear never again, you know. I went on periods of riding the wagon, you know, as the old saying goes, swearing off completely. I was able to do that. I quit from varying periods of 6 weeks to 6 months to one period, 14 months, never took a drink. And then started in again, believing that if I could quit for 14 months, I could certainly have the ability to control the number of drinks I took. But after getting by with drinking socially for 3 or 4 months, I suddenly woke up one morning, I'd been dead drunk, didn't remember where I had been, loss of memory, blackout as it's commonly called, and realized finally, that for me to drink was to die, that I was destroying myself, I was destroying my children, my family, and everything around me to continue to drink. The people I loved the most were the ones I was hurting the most and destroying the most.
Senator Hughes is bitter about President Nixon not funding the bill on alcoholism passed last year by both houses of Congress.
I get increasingly angry because I think what is happening in this administration is not only dereliction and lack of understanding of what's wrong in America, without any consideration for the ailing alcoholic and the knowledge we have for recovery, treatment, rehabilitation, prevention in this country, but is really criminal to the extent that they know it and they're refusing to do anything about it. This bill was passed by a vote of 86-0 in the Senate. It was passed unanimously without a dissenting vote on a voice vote in the House, signed by the President of the United States, and now they have given it a fiscal veto. They haven't recommended one penny for the supplemental bills this year, nor have they recommended one dime for the bill for the next fiscal year.
What has Senator Hughes' recovery from alcoholism meant to him?
When I quit drinking, I was driving a truck. Since I quit drinking, everything has been an improvement. As a result of that, when you move out of a problem of drinking and you face the realities of the world without alcohol, I think then you focus the best you are on what life really is around you, and you're willing to face it squarely and openly. You learn to look at yourself for what you are, good, bad, indifferent. You assess it, and you move out into life with that, without fear. I quit running from things when I quit drinking. You face life, whatever the problem is today, now, and squarely. And there's joy in doing that. There's a joy in being free, and I'm free. I'm free to do anything I want to.
I think for the first time, I feel like I'm about 16 and starting to do things for the first time all over again, like to go out with men, to have friends, to my job's going well. I wake up every day not sick, with a hangover and full of remorse and guilt and fear of what I did last night. But I wake up, with a perspective of it's one, another day, and I'm alive.
I like to think of it in terms of waking up. an awareness of myself, which led to an awareness of the world around me. And I mean that in very tangible terms. I mean of rooms, of places, of streets, of pictures, of colors. This brings the kind of freedom that I never knew before.
The hope that each day I can grow closer to becoming a human being that cares, that can show concern, that can love life, that can just be and just be glad to be. That's the joy of living for me.